Welcome to the Life Self-Mastery podcast, where we bring in entrepreneurs who have created online businesses and improved their lifestyles. Here's your host, Rohit Malhotra.
Hi everyone, this is Rohit from Life Self-Mastery, and today I'm excited to have Justin Smith, who is a managing partner at Recharge Capital, a leading thematic-first private investment firm focused on driving innovation and impact across various sectors, including fintech infrastructure, women's healthcare, synthetic biology, semiconductor enablement, and digital assets. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks for having me, Rod. I appreciate it.
Awesome. So you have an interesting story. You've been part of the VC firm, and then you started Recharge Capital. But what got you interested in this crazy world of venture capital and startups?
Yeah, sure. I originally went to school down in Texas, and actually came out of school as an auditor for Ernst & Young. Loved what I learned at Ernst & Young, but really had the itch to invest. I'd always been investing in public markets. I didn't know much about venture capital whatsoever, let alone private equity. And when I came up to New York, I actually joined a soccer team with a bunch of free agents. I didn't have a single friend in the city, and I figured, well, soccer is something I'm halfway decent at, so maybe people actually hang out with me if I get on their team. And it just so happened that team that got together back in, what was it, 2012 or 2013, happened to be made up of several early employees at both Uber and Slack. And so those were still early days. Uber had been a successful company at that point, but not nearly successful as it obviously is now 11 years later. But those guys and girls, we started sharing some deal flow. They started putting some small checks into angel bets. And that's where I started to get into tech. At the time when I moved up to New York, I was working for Providence Equity Partners at that point and doing mostly more mature later stage deals. And once I started doing these angel checks, it was so amazing to learn about the different technologies, whether it was fintech or healthcare, or consumer. And it was so cool. That's what I wanted to do. And so I ultimately left Providence and joined a firm called Tusk Ventures at the time, which was really focused on consumer tech, specifically consumer tech that was operating in regulated industries and needed help on the regulatory front. That was a great introduction. We were somewhat generalists for what we covered in consumer. But that first portfolio, we did some awesome deals. We invested in Lemonade early on, which was a renter's insurance company that ended up IPOing a few years ago. We were in Roman, or now Roe, which has become a healthcare company. We were invested in Bird Scooters, which obviously didn't have a super great outcome, but we still did pretty well on that one. And we were also in Coinbase, which was commonly known to a lot of people as a crypto exchange. And then last we did FanDuel as well, which now has also gone public and competes with DraftKings. So it was just like a really nice experience getting a bunch of different stuff in venture. But it was after Tusk that I really kind of realized, well, building out a sourcing network is very important, but it's also very important to have people that trust you, that want to put your money with you and give you discretion on how to invest. And so I started getting into the SPV world. I created Chaos Ventures back in 2019. And started taking a bunch of my allocations and relationships with founders and putting them on the AngelList platform, as well as some of the other platforms that exist today, like Sidecar and Allocations, and even doing a few of the SPVs manually myself. That was awesome. That took off way bigger than I ever thought it would. I brought a partner into that, and we ended up raising roughly $60+ million over 120 different SPVs. And it covered the whole gamut of fintech, healthcare, frontier technologies, AI, blockchain. Really learned a lot. Learned about good deals, learned about bad deals, learned about good and bad dynamics on cap tables. And then I ultimately raised a fund back in 2021 of about $25 million to do venture for Recharge. And within Recharge, we invest primarily in three main pillars of synthetic biology, fintech, and healthcare. And our primary focus is on building out sustainable distribution moats for our portfolio companies that allow to get them from basically Series C to Series A very quickly. So I've loved venture, and that's sort of how I got into it and basically continuing it from there.
Got interesting. Yeah, I'll talk about your experience in the VC world, but you also had a small stint in Rocket as a BDM partnerships guy. And, you know, I've been into BDM partnerships for quite a long time, but what was your experience there? And, you know, what would be your learning for somebody who wants to get into, you know, business development and partnerships and really want to, you know, scale themselves as a partnership or a BD leader?
Totally. Yeah. Look, Rocket is such an interesting company. Basically, you know, they're an Australia / New York based company that sells software into large e-commerce players. And so it's, you know, they're essentially selling advertising space on the confirmation page of very large e-commerce players like Gap and Live Nation, Ticketmaster and Uber. And, you know, they make a lot of money doing it. It's an amazing free cash flowing business. I came in there to basically run one of their sales teams and BD teams doing their new partnerships and new product development. We were trying to take their technology and not just have it on the confirmation page, but also bring it in transaction to the payment page and the product details page that brought us both into partnerships as well as competitive processes with fintechs like the buy now, pay laters, like Klarna and Scalapay and some of these other companies. I really wanted to do an operator job alongside doing venture. And so I actually did Rock while I was running Chaos Ventures at the same time. But I also wanted to get experience that was outside of the CPA world and accounting and finance world, because I actually am a CPA by background. I think it's a great background to have. But as it related to kind of like the core workflows within a business, I really see it as a three-pronged approach. There's your engineers, there's your product, and there's your go-to-market salespeople. And I think the biggest learning that I took out of my experience with Rocked was the sensitivity and importance around the communication channels between go-to-market, product, and engineers is so, so critical. And product sort of serves as almost like a translation layer for both the engineers and the go-to-market. Go-to-market, we're out there, we're getting feedback from customers on what they want and they don't want. Engineers are always thinking about like the latest and greatest bells and whistles they can put on products, regardless of whether the customer wants it or not. And so product does a very good job of sort of marrying the two. And I think being able to see both the good and the bad of those communication dynamics has made me a heck of a lot better investor, because those types of dynamics don't show up in pitch decks. And they definitely don't show up in the verbal pitches from founders, because nobody's really going to dive into the team dynamics that way. So it's something that I'm really on the outlook for now when we study management teams very early on. And really, not only that, but also try to understand how they're building out their teams. Because when you think about it, you give somebody $2 million, they're raising a pre-seed or a seed. Now they're going to go out and hire people. Well, who do they hire? You know, they're going to need people around product design. They're going to need certain types of engineers, front end and back end. And they're ultimately going to need BDs or sales staff in some way. And a lot of times with very early stage companies at the seed, your best BD / salesperson is usually the founder. And so that's okay. The issue that they always run into is eventually that baton needs to be passed, and whatever the special sauces the founder has to be scaled to other individuals so that the business can scale their go-to-market strategy. So that was a huge takeaway I got from Rocked, and it was really awesome experience.
I think it's really interesting what you mentioned about you know, having an operating experience and then also, you know, running a investment vehicle, because, you know, I tried to run a SPV on side. I've done a bit of angel investing, but I think it has helped me become a better operator as well as be a better investor at the same time, since I understand, you know, what are the dynamics. But but interestingly, you know, you also mentioned that you worked at Tusk Ventures, and then you led about leading syndicates at Recharge Capital. So what is the sort of mindset, you know, change that needs to go from investing into from an institutional, you know, capital, then to leading, you know, SPVs or doing angel investing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, look, all else being equal, it's amazing doing SPVs because it allows you to have like separate investments not related to a fund. And obviously with the economics of a fund, you have to return an entire fund before you really make any money off of it. But I will say when you're running SPVs, you know, it's not necessarily discretion over that capital. I mean, we're running marketing processes for every single deal that we do. And ultimately, you know, I serve as a filter for my LPs that get to look at these deals, but they ultimately make the decision on how much they want and whether they're going to invest or not at all. The difference with the fund is clearly in like the discretion of that capital, and that comes from building trust with people. So people start to trust you and they realize, well, I love doing these deals, but it also takes time to read the memos and really, you know, get up to speed on everything that you're going to put your money in. And ultimately, it comes down to LPs wanting to scale their own deployment by investing into funds as opposed to direct deals, because the funds allow them to get exposure and not have to spend as much time looking directly at something that honestly, a lot of times they don't even know what it is, because maybe they haven't invested in that area before. And there's always a ramp up period to kind of get in the know so that you make a decent decision on what you're doing. But the fund really comes down to we're running a business. And so with having discretion over that capital and getting paid fees for basically running that capital, there are reporting requirements. There is technology layered into the stack of what I'm doing every day, everything from how we keep our pipeline and what we're looking at, to how we report to LPs and how we manage cash at the management company level. And we have to be a lot more proactive about how we source. Whereas in like the SPV world, you know, you've got these broad networks, you can meet lots of interesting founders. When you have a fund and you have a particular mandate, you have to be a lot more thoughtful for where you spend your time. And so at Recharge, especially, we spend a lot of time creating workflow maps. So similar to kind of market maps that are created by other VCs, where they might stratify the fintech universe into like 8 or 9 different areas. We do the same thing within particular workflows. So for instance, you know, we look at the mortgage servicing workflow where we service US mortgages and we help people pay their mortgages, but we ultimately also upsell them other fintech products. So we'll map out that entire workflow and all the touch points with the consumer throughout their life and identify areas like, you know, this particular consumer has been in their home for 11 years and interest rates have dropped 200 basis points. So, you know, they're going to refi. And we want to get into the refi business. We want to actually recapture that loan and originate it. That's an income spot. Or, you know, this particular family has been living in this home for 5 years and they just had a child. That's usually a great time to buy life insurance. So we want to start to upsell them life insurance. And so, you know, basically in short, we build out these workflow maps. We identify companies that are building in these spaces that we might want to invest in. And then we're also basically looking for white spaces and gaps in these workflows that allow us to incubate our own companies that can capture that particular market. So that's really, you know, the biggest difference between SPV and running the fund. I think the SPVs are definitely more opportunistic, whereas the fund is more focused on these particular distribution networks that we've built out.
Got interesting, but did SPVs help you in building a VC fund, or do you think your experience at Tusk Ventures were more relevant over there?
I think both equally. You know, I think working at Tusk really allowed me to have a brand name behind me and build out an initial network. And when you have capital behind you, it's always easier to be able to get meetings with entrepreneurs and squeeze yourself into competitive rounds, especially if you can move fast and be punctual about your process. But the SPVs were what allowed me to really build relationships directly with LPs, because when people see the deals that we're looking at, the LPs would reach out, you know, want to chat with me, get my thoughts on the company, and it allowed me to build that direct relationship because they were seeing how I thought about stuff. And so, for me, it benefited to have both, plus the operating background, because it allowed me to actually be helpful to founders in early stage because I've done some of this stuff before. But I do think that, you know, it is possible to raise a venture fund off of doing SPVs, but there is a professionalism that comes with running a fund that you might miss out on if you're just doing hundreds of SPVs and not really thinking about it. And it ultimately comes down to a fiduciary duty. When somebody gives you their capital, you become a steward of that capital. And so, yes, you're promising them that you're going to get them into awesome deals, and that's great. And, you know, there's always a chance of that not succeeding, but ultimately you're also running a business. Yeah. And I think working at Tusk allowed me to see the inner workings of the workflow stack for a venture firm. So that I could rebuild it at Recharge when we've done that here. And I think with the SPVs, they do outsource a lot of it. I mean, some of it gets outsourced to AngelList and Carta, and that's great that they've set those up. But ultimately, I don't see those platforms as super scalable if you get much larger. And so with Recharge, especially because I've built this before at Tusk, I created everything customized in Recharge and how we work through our communications with LPs, our outreach for co-investments, and ultimately how we do our sourcing as well. So
Got it. Interesting. And, you know, I read one of the interviews on Lost Money In, which is a newsletter run by Calm Ventures and Riverside, where you mentioned that, you know, you look at angel investing as more of a way to build partnerships rather than a way to build wealth. And that's a very interesting analogy because, you know, sometimes it just takes 7 to 10 years to get an exit. You know, obviously you've been into partnerships and you've been into, you know, building relationships. But, you know, how many investments should an investor make in the portfolio to diversify their investment portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, you mean from the LP side, if they're looking at a bunch of different syndicate investments?
Yes.
I mean, for me, outside of the stuff I just do at Chaos, I probably have another 50 investments I've made through just other syndicates. I worry a lot less about the fees. I mean, yeah, it's annoying paying fees sometimes especially for deals where I actually know the company. I'm like, well, I could get an allocation of this if I wanted to. But like at the end of the day, when you're, especially where I'm investing is like at the seed stage, if the thing works out, then the fees just don't matter. They really don't. We are going to do really, really well. I do have issues with some of these like double layered SPVs and these secondaries that ultimately have like very large 10 to 15% management fee structures in them. I think people should avoid those. I think it may, especially for a lot of these that are pre-IPO, I think when you're already starting down 20% on an investment on day one, it's really hard to kind of make that up and make it worth your while. But I know some of those rounds for certain companies like Anthropic and Scale and SpaceX are very, very hard to get into. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, it is a numbers game. I prefer to be more concentrated, but I think I can be more concentrated because I've made a lot of mistakes. You know, I've seen things that work and don't work. And so I know some pattern recognition for that. Not to say that I'm perfect by any means on it, but I know some of the less than obvious things to not fall for now. And so when I see a company in a space that I really, really like, and the numbers look good, and I think the management team is trustworthy, you know, I'll do a relatively large size angel check into that as opposed to spreading $1,000 bets everywhere. But I think if you're kind of like a normal retail investor and most of your money is sitting in, you know, a Schwab account and investing in public markets or, you know, your 401k, and you want to get some exposure to venture, well, there's really no large retail product to do that except investing in syndicates. And so what I would do is follow what I think are the top 10 syndicates by deal volume. And I would start to read those memos and get to know them and make, you know, a few investments a year that are relatively small, but use it mostly as a learning experience. And then maybe it even turns into a recruiting experience for you or a partnership experience. And ultimately, like, that's been the biggest value add of SPVs into cap tables is, you know, we have the underlying cap table for each of our SPVs and all the individuals that are investing. And we've gone and tagged each of these people with metadata on who they are, you know, using their LinkedIns, where they work, what their interests are. And a lot of times it's great because I'll get somebody that invests, call it, you know, $20,000, which isn't, you know, a ton of money in the grand scheme of things, but it's a lot to that person. And so now they really care about this company they invested in. And by the way, they're an executive at, you know, SoftBank or Deutsche Bank or whatever, and they can be strategic to the founder. And so we make that connection and all of a sudden that SPV that might only be investing, call it $200,000, has really been a value add to the founder, which is amazing. And so, you know, we try to do that as much as possible.
Got it. Interesting. And, yeah, you know, before the call, we talked about, you know, distribution channels and, you know, how I worked in worked at OYO and, you know, they had a lot of distribution channels. And you have a very interesting insight about, you know, how startups who raise seed funding don't understand about that much about distribution channels. So can you elaborate more about, you know, how can startups build up a moat where, you know, they can add up those distribution channels, especially in fintech and healthcare?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like our opinion at seed stage is distribution is the number one issue on why there's a cold start problem on getting from zero to one. And so what we've really tried to build out at Recharge with our infrastructure is sustainable distribution moats that we can continue to invest and build companies in the future that can leverage these distribution moats. And so one example of that is we are big in the women's healthcare space around IVF specifically, in vitro fertilization. And so we have a company that we created a few years ago that is buying, acquiring, and operating clinics throughout various regions, predominantly Southeast Asia. And so these clinics allow us to cater to IVF patients, mostly in Asia, and basically provide them technology-enabled services and upsell services. So when you look at the workflow for a patient going through IVF, there's multiple opportunities for us to, A, bring down the costs using technology of getting the core IVF service, but then B, also upsell them other services that might be relevant for where they are in the particular process. Everything from postpartum depression to mental health to traditional Chinese medicine. I mean, the sky is really the limit, not to mention there's financing and insurance that we can provide as well. And so that's how Recharge is built out. We have three major distribution channels that we have built out over the last 4 years. One is in fintech, one is in women's healthcare and fertility, and the other is in synthetic biology. And so the idea is that entrepreneurs that are building in these spaces understand this is what we've built, and we can help get them into these networks through exclusive partnerships that allow them to sell directly into it, which allows them to do two things. One, it allows them to get initial distribution and sell through a product, but then it also ultimately allows them to iterate on their product so they can create something scalable. And so that is really the biggest focus. You know, and another example of that is a company that we just helped create recently called MCard, which is a credit card to pay mortgages, very similar to Bilt card that's used to pay rent. You might think, well, Bilt can compete in that space. That's true, but the mortgage market is also a $1 trillion market. So where's our edge? Well, our edge is through one of our other portfolio companies called Valon, which is a unicorn now and services several hundred thousand mortgagees in the United States. And so what we're going to do with MCard is distribute into this homeowner ecosystem that we basically own and control. And we don't even need a ton of conversion percentage on that to basically get this company to a Series A. And then from there, they can build out other distribution moats through other mortgage servicers and home builders and developers. And the sky's really the limit on that. But that's the idea. Companies starting from scratch, trying to get those initial distribution moats, we can guarantee those at really good terms and allow these companies to then go out and have actual KPIs they can raise larger amounts of capital on.
Got it. Interesting. And you know, I've seen a lot of, especially in pre-seed and seed rounds, the lot of big brand name on the cap table. What is your view on, you know, big brand names getting on those cap tables? And what advice you give to founders who are trying to get those brand names at seed stage?
At the seed stage? Yeah. I mean, look, I think every founder is incentivized to try and get the best brand name you can on the cap table because it helps with really three things, three C's. I mean, it can help you drive like new customer partnerships because people see you as more legitimate. It can help with driving recruitment, you know, because, you know, some of the better engineers or product developers or whatever will be attracted to that brand name. And then it also attracts with capital because obviously, you know, especially in the retail space, if you see the brand names, you assume that a lot of diligence has been done and that you'd like to tag along to that. What I do see more often now, especially post 2021 and 2022, is the seed stage is a lot more clubbed up than it used to be. I think when there was like a huge influx of capital from 2016 through 2021, it was really competitive and people had pretty sharp elbows at the seed stage. And now that we're in this sort of kind of like crammed up capital environment, you've got a lot of these seed stage companies in 2020 and 2021 that raised at way too high valuations. And now capital markets are closed off to them and they've got a brand name VC on their cap table that is either not paying any attention to them or doesn't want to follow on or you know, basically they're going to have to do a down round. And they also might have trouble doing that because a lot of their voting control is held by one individual. So I think founders have gotten smarter to this and realized that when they're raising in these really early stages, it's as important, if not more important, to get as many people participating as possible and have a vested interest in the outcome of your company. You can always bring on the brand name later on, especially if you perform, to get them to bring in the much bigger check. I think it's fine to get a brand name involved from like their scouting programs or a smaller check, but I would always be hesitant to as a founder to have my entire round filled out by one party. I think those days, not to say they won't ever return, but I think for the foreseeable future, they're not around. So that's what I mean when I say clubbed rounds. I see a lot more people having less sharp elbows and really working together to go, hey, look, we're both two big brand name VCs, but we don't know what's going to happen with this company. And I want your network and you want my network. So let's split the round and go in together on this and, you know, help each other out. And I do see a lot more of that going on now than what was happening previously.
Got it. And would you see more or less M&A in the next 12 months?
I think M&A is starting to pick up a little bit for sure. I mean, it depends on the industry. I think right now what you got is a lot of kind of vulture type activity going on out there with M&A. There's huge amounts of down rounds. There are some interesting companies, especially at the Series B and Series C level, that have good KPIs, but also unfortunately got caught up in this euphoric stage of raising at valuations that were too high. And so there is a great asset there, but now they're running low on cash. They need to raise again. It needs to be done at a lower valuation. And in those cases, I'm seeing some like strategic acquisitions happening that makes sense on the whole for everybody. Even though it's obviously not the outcome everybody wanted, it's still kind of a safe face outcome for both the investor base and for the management team. In that light, I do see some M&A activity coming in because there's a cash crunch, not necessarily because the M&A coffers are super high right now and everybody's being acquisitive. I think it's a very one-off strategic transaction going on at the moment.
Got it. And what do you see as the single biggest misalignment between VCs and LPs, especially what had happened from 2022 to 2023?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, I think one of the biggest ones is the way the VC model works is heavily related to how asset management works, where you can play the AUM game. And it's been problematic because the way the capital should be deployed into innovation, inherently by the nature of what it is, it needs to be smaller than private equity and credit and some of these bigger asset classes. And so with some of these larger managers on the VC side, they got the bug and the itch to go and raise bigger AUM and get into the growth equity and more private equity. And in Sequoia's case, trying to even get into public markets where they have, you know, these funds that essentially are a continuation of holding these assets forever. And I can understand, you know, there's merit to that. When you look back at like the Google's return characteristics and Apple from their IPOs to now versus what they did in private markets, I mean, there's still obviously a lot of value left on the table. If you're investing out of a 10-year fund and you decide to start liquidating stuff that either is about to go public or just went public. And so I can understand why they went those directions. The problem is like for true venture investing, especially at the seed stage, getting that size of AUM first has the effect. I call it like the tiger effect, where all of a sudden seed stage companies are trading more like Series A because, you know, you've got a company that should raise about $4 million in capital. But then a very large fund comes in and says, hey, I'll actually give you 8 at double the valuation. So they're buying in at the same percentage they would have bought in anyways, but they're doubling the size of the round. And for the founders, like that sounds great. They're like, oh, I've got more capital. I've got a higher valuation. I basically got to combine my seed and my A round so I don't have to do the A later. The issue is like the ultimate kind of like discretion on that capital falls to the CEO and founders to allocate it among engineers and different types of investments. And the decision-making doesn't just scale. Like the decisions you need to make on how you're going to allocate $4 million doesn't become easier over 8 or 12 or 16. It actually just becomes harder because you got to figure out where to spend that money. And so I do think, I mean, I'm biased, obviously, I'm like the emerging managers in these smaller funds, but I think to have really effective pre-seed and seed investing, it's best coming from these smaller funds because they're incentivized in better ways to help these companies at an early stage get the LP base involved and ultimately produce co-investment opportunities for the winners as well. Whereas the really large funds are playing a numbers game, both on the AUM and number of portfolio companies, and can be helpful as well. But the flip side that you're never going to hear about is the bad behavior, because they invest in so many companies, the ones that are not doing well, they stop paying attention to them. They really do. I mean, I hear time and time again, founders telling me, oh, I got this, you know, tier one that's invested, haven't heard from them in 8 months because we haven't been doing as well, you know, and that's just, that's the nature of the game and how the numbers game works. So.
And what advice would you give to managers on when and how to take liquidity in the best positions, especially, you know, when it's a 7 to 10 year fund?
That's a hard one because it also depends on what the goal of the manager is. If the manager is really trying to build out a franchise and be able to raise more capital, then DPI is the only number that really matters. And so in order to build more trust with an LP base and get them to invest more money with you, it's really important to return the capital and hopefully generate return on that capital that they originally gave you. And so when, you know, we've dealt with this a few times on some of our investments where we're sitting in a investment that we might have made at the seed stage and we have an opportunity to get out at the Series C in a secondary, you know, we have to kind of consider, do we take some of the chips off the table and provide DPI to investors because that makes a great story versus, hey, should we hold on to this because it's going to definitely be worth more? And to be honest, it's a different underwriting process every time because you really have to look at it almost as a new investment. And obviously, if I'm selling something just to produce DPI for marketing purposes, if that's not the right decision to make because so much more money is going to be made for these LPs later on, then you would obviously want to stay in that investment. I think it's prudent to take money off the table. I mean, I can tell you, like at Tusk, we did that with like Bird, for instance, you know, and it turned out to be the right decision because Bird flopped in public markets. And so I think it becomes a different underwriting decision every single time.
Got it. And you mentioned about reserves, but you mentioned DPI, but do you think reserves hurt DPI? And, you know, should a fund have a reserve allocation to do follow-on investments?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if reserves necessarily hurts DPI, but I think follow-on investments are really important. The fact is like investing at the seed and pre-seed is really, really hard. I mean, there are so many variables that go into creating a winner, and many of those variables are out of your control completely. And so what's really important for fund dynamics is when you look back at funds, whether they are concentrated funds or even spread out, it really does become sort of a small percentage of positions that drive the returns for a particular fund. I mean, that's the case in most funds. And so that's why it's really important. Once you do find a horse that really is working and you can build off of that, that you have capital in reserve to double down on those positions. So yeah, while that might kind of hurt, you know, being able to both incubate new companies and get in at lower valuations, you're obviously averaging up when you're doing these follow-ons at higher and higher prices. But the goal is for venture, you know, if I can produce pretty consistent 40% to 50%+ net IRR returns for investors over a large time scale, that's a really good venture strategy. It really is. And so you ultimately need to produce DPI to actually get the realized IRR, which is very, very important. In order to basically size up and be able to deploy an entire fund, follow-on percentages is super important. I mean, I'll tell you, for us at Recharge, we have follow-on reserves that are anywhere from 50 to 60% of the fund, but that's because we're very concentrated. So we'll only maybe incubate or invest in maybe 2 or 3 companies a year that are starting their businesses to distribute into our networks. And then our plan is we are going to lead the seed. We are going to either co-lead or invest heavily into the A. And we're going to take very concentrated bets on these particular companies because we feel we have an outsized influence on their outcomes.
Got it. And when it comes to decision making, you know, how do you look at investing decisions and reach out capital? Do you look at, you know, postmortems, or do you make, you know, solo decisions when it comes to making those investments?
Yeah, the way we're set up right now, I mean, it's we have a few partners that work at the platform level. That work on different things. So for instance, our healthcare partner, she's actually the CEO for our fertility roll-up strategy. And so while she's a partner at Recharge, her full-time job is actually the CEO of that company. We've got our other partner, the founder, that really works on ideation of the different distribution channels, like trying to figure out good anchor assets that we can build off of. And so when it comes to the venture decision making for our firm right now, it really just comes down to me in combination with the founding partner on figuring out what types of technologies and services fit best into the distribution channels we've already built out. So ultimately, the discussion comes down to me as the GP, but it would behoove me to invest in companies that don't fit nicely into the kind of like channels that we've already built out. And so that's how we're structured in terms of postmortems and going back on certain investments. I mean, we've been lucky to not have any of our major investments go sideways, even during this environment. Everything is still growing very nicely. But I think I also credit a lot of that to how thoughtful we are when we map out our ecosystems. You know, whereas a lot of VCs will spend time, especially at their analyst level, creating these large market maps and breaking up healthcare and fintech into all these different layers, we go really deep into our specific workflows, whether it's a fertility workflow or a mortgage servicing workflow. And within that workflow, we really identify two areas. One is technology enablers that can help increase efficiencies and output of that workflow, or ancillary services and products that can be upsold into that workflow. And so those two areas are sort of how we stratify the universe on where we spend our time. So I both think about white space where we can build, and I go out and look for companies that are already building in that space that we could basically slot into these particular distribution channels and workflows.
Got it. And Justin, do you think ownership is, you know, core to a company's top performance? Do you think a company, a firm should have at least a 20% allocation in the company to do really well?
Well, I think it depends on the deal, because every deal has a different set of legal documents with different types of investor rights based on sizes. You know, a lot of VCs these days will focus heavily on a 10% ownership. In a way, I think a lot of that is more ego-driven than it is actual, practicality-driven. And I think it's because it's nice to show LPs that you're able to get at least a 10% allocation to these rounds. But ultimately, it comes down to control and influence over the cap table. And so the percentage ownership required to have control and influence over a cap table is different for every single deal. I'll say when we incubate, we do aim for between 12 and 15% on those incubations. And a lot of that is sort of based on a rough math that we do, figuring out, well, when this company goes out and raises their A and their B and automatically gets to profitability, what type of percentage ownership would we want to have to still have good influence over that cap table? And so a lot of times that's how we're kind of like backing into these numbers. But that doesn't mean that we won't do deals that, you know, especially with GPs that we have a very close relationship with. There are deals I've led before where they actually have a larger percentage ownership in the initial round because they're a bigger capital provider. I know I can bring them in, and now I have eyes on the Series A and Series B and downstream capital. And I still have control and influence over the company because I'm the one that's really working on the board and helping them with basically, executing on the distribution channel that we're setting up. I think, 20% is also pretty high. I don't really see too many VCs going strictly for 20% because, as I said, a lot of these are getting clubbed up now, too. So it's hard to just take down 20, 30% of a round and not have anybody else involved.
Got it. I quickly want to do the top three. What's your favorite business book?
So favorite business book, I really enjoyed Snowball, which is the biography for Warren Buffett. But the book I'm reading right now is called The Price of Time. And it really is about the creation of interest and where it came from and what interest is supposed to represent. It's quite interesting. So I think that's probably one of my favorites, at least right now, although I'm biased.
Karan, we'll put that in the show notes. And, if you could go back in time when you started building Recharge Capital, what is the one thing you would have focused on or done things differently?
Yeah, I think the one thing I would have focused on is being, it kind of goes back to what I learned with my sales process over at Rock. It's like, there is such thing as spreading yourself too thin over a sales process. And whereas at Recharge, we had about 65 LPs in our first fund, which was awesome. They're all amazing relationships, and I'm glad that we have them all. But for those 65 we have, there's probably another 600 or so that I talk to and like have developed some relationships with, but maybe they haven't invested with us yet, either in a deal or in a fund. And a lot of GPs that I know that have kind of started from scratch, like really build off of kind of like a concentrated LP base. I mean, even when you look at some of the larger funds, you would be surprised to know that their LP bases are quite concentrated as well, among some like very large checks, mostly coming from overseas. And I think to save some headache on our sales process for early parts of recharge, I would have been a little bit more concentrated on where I spent my time as opposed to spreading myself very thin. One of the years that we were fundraising, I flew over 300,000 miles, you know, throughout the world. Twice I actually went around the entire globe, which is a really weird sensation because you're literally in every single time zone. But that part wears you out. And I think that's a real cost for doing business. And I think that we could be where we are right now, if not even further, just being a little bit more concentrated on kind of like our relationships and spending time with them and really growing those particular relationships.
Got it. Makes sense. And, you know, what's a favorite online tool, for example, Gmail, Slack, Zoom?
Favorite online tool? Oh, there's a lot of online tools I hate. I would say, I mean, I'd have to give credit to AngelList. I think AngelList, you know, although there are some issues I have with part of their product specs and the way they've changed their pricing over time, I got to really give it to them. The platform they created and that constantly growing LP base and just the ease of being able to link your bank account, allow investors to come in, and then the management of it after is relatively easy too. They've built a great tool for SPVs and syndications. And like I said, I've used all the platforms like Sidecar and Allocations, all of them. And they've all got their pros and cons, but I will say, despite AngelList's, you know, hiccups and, you know, their issues on finding a sustainable business model, they've by far built, I think, the largest and best product in the market for doing SPVs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. We'll put that in show notes. And Justin, what is the best way people can reach out to you and know more about Recharge Capital?
Yeah, easiest way. I mean, look, I try to do as few Zoom calls as possible nowadays. If people are in New York City, I'm always open for a coffee. But my email is probably the best to get in touch with me, you know, justin@rechargecapital.com. And I have no issues giving that out because I already get hundreds of spam emails and I unsubscribe from 50 newsletters per week. So it doesn't really matter. But every now and then I get emails from really interesting people and I never want to close myself off to that because, you know, life is short. I like to meet a lot of interesting people.
Got it. We'll put that in the show notes. Justin, thank you so much for taking our time and speaking to us. I really enjoyed my conversation with you.
Awesome. Same here, Rohit. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks for listening to the Life Self-Mastery podcast, where we teach you how to start and grow your online business. For more information, visit Rohit's blog at www.lifeselfmastery.com.